Now, detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
So, who lost a rock? Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. There's a long tradition in American politics, and maybe it's just human nature, to try to put the blame on somebody when something goes sideways. Foreign policy, military initiative, you know, even sports trades. We've got to find somebody to blame as a scapegoat. And right now it's easy and perhaps overly simplistic to look at what's happened in Iraq and Syria with the rise of the Islamic State and lay the blame on the Obama administration. Those with a longer view might look back and say, well, the seeds of this were planted in 2003 when the Bush administration decided to abolish the Iraqi army and abolish the Ba'ath Party, which created the core of what we now know as the Islamic State, the out-of-work career military men in Iraq. But is there more to it than that? For an expert look, we turn to our guest who's got a PhD in Islamic history from The Ohio State University. He's served as an Arabic linguist in the 101st Airborne. He's been a consultant to U.S. Special Operations Command and to the intelligence community. And he's got a couple of books just released, which are very timely, given what's happening in the Middle East. Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate, and 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps, Essays on Muslim Eschatology, 2005 to 2015. Dr. Timothy Furnish. Tim, welcome back to the bunker.
Glad to be here, Derek.
The Islamic State, as I summarized, and again, perhaps overly simplistically, is comprised of a group that grew out of the disaffected remnant of the officer corps of the Iraqi military, or at least so we're told. Sunnis, career military men who suddenly had no career options, found themselves in jail together and got radicalized. So we can possibly point a finger at the Bush administration's decision to go that route. The Obama administration, which knew from the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2012 that arming al-Qaeda in Iraq might result in an independent Islamic State that would destabilize Syria and Iraq. That was according to the documents released by Judicial Watch earlier this year. But is there more to it than that? What is it about that part of the world that has given rise to the apocalyptic worldview of the Islamic State?
Well, let's try to break this down here, Derek. There are really sort of three facets to the Islamic State in terms of whom it's comprised of. One is, as you correctly point out, disaffected and former members of Saddam's military, who were ostensibly secular, who were Sunni, but ostensibly secular, because Saddam, remember, was an Arab socialist, much like his analogous rulers, I guess you could say, over in Syria, the Assads, both Hafez the father and now Bashar the son. They were Arab socialists, members of what's called the Ba'ath Party. Now, so these guys, after we took Saddam down, these guys were, as you said, out of work, and they gravitated over to the main Sunni opposition to the United States. But they did not, however, create it. They did not create ISIS, nor did they create the predecessor movements, which were the al-Qaeda in Iraq, basically. There was the Islamic State of Iraq. Before that, basically, it was an al-Qaeda adjunct in Iraq. And then before that, it was even something called Tawhid wa Jihad. So these guys were your basic Sunni fundamentalist jihadists who wanted an Islamic State and wanted to get rid of Saddam. So it's a bit ironic that some of the former colonels and such in Saddam's military joined forces with these guys. But they eventually, of course, discovered they had more in common than they had differences. And there's another major element to this, which to some degree overlaps these two. There is a strong element in the Islamic State of a Sufi group, an Islamic mystical group, from what's called the Naqshbandi order, which is one of the many Sufi orders and mystical orders in Islam that still exist in the modern world, called Jaish al-Rijawa al-Naqshbandiya, which is the army of the men of the Naqshbandi order, basically. And under Saddam, it seems that a lot of the ostensibly secular officer corps actually belonged to Sufi organization, which in some ways is sort of like belonging to, you know, the Rotary Club or the Lodge or something in the United States. But in another way, it's not, because the Sufi orders, by and large, in Islam, still have retained a very real religious, as I said earlier, religious mystical element. And generally in Islamic history, these Sufi mystics tend to be at loggerheads with the Salafi jihadists that usually make up your groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and so on. But, as I point out in a number of my books, particularly one of the new ones that's out, the 10 Years Captivation book, some of the most violent jihads in Islamic history have been led by these Sufis. So they're not simply sort of, you know, Quakers with beards and guys who sit around and meditate on Allah all day. They sometimes take up arms and fight. In this Naqshbandi order, which is very prominent in Iraq going back to even pre-Ottoman times, was one of the ones most renowned for being jihadists. So in a sense, it's not that much of a stretch to see why these guys would link up with people fighting what they see as occupiers. And then after that, of course, after we've left, they are Sunni. Most Sufis are Sunnis, and they see a country, they see Iraq being ruled by the Shia majority as not a safe place for them, as well as an aberration. So they have these three elements sort of have come together to make up the core of the Islamic State. Now, as far as what else you mentioned, the eschatological part of this, you've got a lot of Muslims who are convinced that we are in the end times. And by end times, it's not exactly the same as when Christians speak of the end times. You know, when we speak of the end times, I'm a Lutheran, I go to church every Sunday and recite either the Nicene or the Apostles' Creed, one of the elements, of course, of which is that Christ will come again to judge the living and the dead. But for most of us, I think it's safe to say that once Christ comes back, you know, history has sort of ended, okay? You're not going to have people fighting wars. I mean, there will be, of course, the Armageddon at the end of time, but you're not going to have nation-state actors, and humans, in a sense, really aren't actors anymore. They're sort of very passive, I guess you could say. It's all on God's timetable. In Islam, it's very different. In Islam, the end time, it's almost a misnomer, in fact, I think, Derek, to say the end times, because in Islam, when the Mahdi, who is the primary messianic figure of Islam, the rightly guided one, which is what Mahdi means, when he comes, and when Jesus comes back, because again, in Islamic thought, Jesus is an Islamic prophet who was not crucified, he was taken to heaven, he will come back, and he will join forces with the Mahdi, basically to fight the forces of evil and take over the world. These two will lead Muslims to take over the world and will establish a worldly state, what some of the writings call Malakut Allah, the kingdom of Allah. And so Jesus and the Mahdi working together basically established this via both violent jihad, conquering the enemies of Islam, who will be led by the sort of the Antichrist figure in Islam called the Dajjal, the deceiver, and his supporters. So this idea, again, it's being ramped up, and groups like ISIS particularly believe in this, and they're working to, I think it's clear that they're trying to, what's called hotwire the apocalypse, they're trying to goad us into attacking, because as you mentioned earlier with the Battle of Dabiq, which is a small town in the Syrian border up near the Syrian-Turkish border. There is a hadith in Islamic tradition that says that the Muslims will fight what's called the Romans, which, of course, when this hadith was written, meant the Byzantines, the Byzantine Christians. And, of course, ISIS conflates us with Crusaders. And who are the Crusaders? It's always the Americans. Maybe the French to a certain extent, but it's always Western Christians. So they are convinced they will win this battle, and if they can just goad us into attacking, putting ground forces, they think they will win it. But again, this is not an extremist or radical view. Belief in the Mahdi is very mainstream, both in not just in Shia Islam, but in Sunni Islam. And the Pew data from 2012, I believe it was, which specifically asked about this question over several Muslim populations, several dozen countries, And the average was about 42% of Muslims responded affirmatively to the question, do you believe the Mahdi will come in your lifetime? So 42% of 1.5 billion is over 600 million people.
That's
so
a lot.
ISIS is exploiting this. I think they clearly believe it, as do other groups in Islam, in Islamic terrorist networks and others, as well as some peaceful groups. But they're clearly, this is an idea that's shared by tens, if not hundreds of millions of Muslims.
So in other words, while Western governments may have seen or perceived an advantage in trying to use this kind of violent strain within Islam to achieve certain foreign policy ends, removing Assad from power, regardless of what the reasons were, the actual root beliefs that led to the creation of an Islamic State and the actions that has taken since then actually go back a lot farther than, farther than even the United States of America.
Right, they go back to the early days of Islam. But I don't think anyone in our government paid any attention to this. I mean, we were clueless about this sort of thing, both the Bush administration and the Obama. Well, the Bush administration was clueless. The Obama administration, I think, is willfully ignorant about it. We have an administration now that won't even admit that jihad is the operative concept driving Islamic terrorism, which is something they shout at us every day. They're not going to even begin to mention anything about apocalyptic beliefs within this. So I don't think we knew anything about this. We did not realize this is on the Bush administration. If they had, and again, by saying this, I'm not saying the Bush administration created ISIS. That's absurd. Islam created ISIS. The Bush administration, by destroying some of the barriers to jihadist takeovers in places like Iraq, in places like, well, Afghanistan is kind of a different case, but basically, particularly in Iraq, you had a government that was a secular government, as we said, socialist, that kept the jihadists and the Salafis, the Islamic fundamentalist Sunnis, at bay. And when you remove that, even if you're ostensibly doing it in the name of democracy, and again, 65% of the population of Iraq is Shia, well, basically what you've done is put in power is the brand of Islam that arguably has the strongest belief in this sort of messianic thing. So, American and Westerners in general, Americans particularly, is woefully unprepared to deal with this because, you know, we won't do our homework and we go barging in and we think that, as we did when the so-called Arab Spring started, right? This is the greatest thing, all the intelligentsia in the administration and I use the term intelligentsia very loosely, But the experts, this is wonderful, the New York Times editorial board and everyone else. Well, under the sort of ridiculous premise that the Arab world, the Muslim world in general, and the Arab world in particular, is chock full of budding Jeffersonian Democrats who, because they're on Twitter, clearly must be Western-style moderates. And once we get rid of, the Mubaraks and the Assads and the Qaddafis of the world, then, a million flowers will bloom. And no, what happened was, by getting rid of people like Mubarak and Gaddafi, and bastard that Gaddafi was, he kept the jihadists at bay in Libya. Basically, you made Libya is a failed state. It's much like Syria. Syria gets all the attention. Libya is basically breaking up into two or three pieces, at least one of which will probably be ruled by jihadists. Mm-hmm. So that's what getting rid of Gaddafi did. And because we have this, Bush had this and Obama has it even in spades and goes different directions with it too. This naive Wilsonian view that the whole world wants what we want. No, there are a lot of people in the Muslim world that want Sharia law and that want Islamic law. A few years ago in Israel, I was fortunate enough to have dinner with some people, one of whom was the former Israeli ambassador to Egypt. And we were talking about this because this was in 2013 and the Arab Spring, quote unquote, was ongoing, of course. And he told me at one point he was in a meeting with Hosni Mubarak, and Mubarak was just livid. He said, don't the Americans understand my people are not ready for democracy? Hosni Mubarak said that. Mm-hmm. He said, maybe they will be in a few decades or a century, but they aren't now.
So, still very tribal.
But we do this. I mean, I can't tell you how many people in the State Department and the intelligence community and even in the military I've run across, although less so, thank God, the military, where people will think that they can't get out of the way they think and put themselves in somebody else's shoes and think like that, which is what you have to do if you want to be a decent analyst. Some people can do this, but then that's probably the people at CENTCOM who got their, you know, reports spiked.
Exactly.
So
yes.
we project onto, I mean, look, we're all guilty of this because we're human, but when you do what I've done for as long as I've done it, this is kind of sad, actually, Derek, but I can actually kind of think like jihadists, and I can think like these messianic guys because I study this stuff all the time. And if you just slip over a little bit and put on the guise of looking at the world from their point of view, even for just a few minutes, you go, wait a minute, this stuff makes sense from their point of view.
Well, yeah, we in the West have trouble understanding why, for example, Boko Haram went and captured all those young girls who had been, you know, sent off to school through initiatives sponsored by Western governments. If you're thinking like them, you're seeing that as a war of cultures, and the Westerners trying to destroy your culture from within. So, in that sense,
and your religion,
yep. And so, mm-hmm. in that sense, the response makes sense. Because they're basically trying to eliminate the what they're seeing as an almost military initiative to try and destroy your culture. Now, obviously, I don't agree with the fact that you're using making girls schoolgirls a military target. But again, if you're thinking with their view of the world, their actions actually make sense.
And what we keep trying to do, you see this all the time, particularly on the left, some on the right do it too, but it's particularly bad on the left, is we try to project what we think is the rationale onto them. Okay, and what's the primary one, Derek? Well, it must be because they're poor and don't have jobs.
Yeah, right.
I mean, and not just idiots like Marie Harf at the State Department say this. This is a common trope. I read The Economist every week, okay? And I read it oftentimes grimacing and, you know, punching the wall or something. But I mean, if you want to know what's going on in the world, The Economist is one of the best places, but their analysis is just ridiculous. The writers of The Economist basically think that Islamic terrorism is caused by poverty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no data to back this up. It's ludicrous. But that's easier. That's projecting onto them what we think it should be. Instead of, why don't we just take the people in ISIS and Boko Haram and Lashkar-e-Taiba and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and I won't go and list the other 47 groups on the State Department International Terrorist Group list, but why don't we just take them at face value and say maybe they're doing it for jihad, which is what they scream at us every day.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to say it has an Islamic basis, and it's not in contra. This is where I have problems with people on the Republican side, too. We keep using this language, Islamic radicalism, radical Islam, Islamic extremism. Folks, jihad is neither radical nor extreme in Islam. It's quite mainstream. The founder of Islam himself waged jihad. Allah enjoins jihad in the Quran multiple times. Things like beheadings were ordered by Muhammad. So until we come to terms with that and admit that at the core of the world's second largest religion, there's a very violent strain that needs to be addressed, we're going to continue to flounder and not be able to deal with this issue.
And the thing that disturbs me a little bit is that in the sort of alternative media community that I inhabit, you know, people are loath to believe anything that they hear from the mainstream media. So whenever you begin talking about the Islamic State or the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or any of the other groups and their radical beliefs as being part and parcel of their faith, immediately the accusations start to fly. Well, you're just regurgitating what you hear on the mainstream media. No, not exactly. And that was kind of the point I was hoping we could get to today with this conversation, let's go back. What are the roots of these beliefs that are manifesting in the actions of the Islamic State today? You mentioned the hadiths. For people who aren't really familiar, the difference between the Quran itself and the hadiths, how do they differ, and how do, say, the different sects, Sunni and Shia, interpret these differently? And then how does that manifest in the way we see the Islamic State acting today?
Right. Okay, well, there are two two bodies of written authority for Muslims. The Quran, of course, is number one. It is believed by the vast majority of Muslims to be literally the word of God, of Allah, and that it applies across space and time, that is, when it was compiled in the 7th or 8th century or perhaps later, we don't know for sure, But they believe that, of course, it was revealed to Muhammad in the 7th century, that it is as valid to Muslims today as it was then, all right? And it should be applied literally, okay? And this is a major difference between the understanding of the Bible among Christians, the world's largest religion, and the understanding of the Quran. Yes, there are many, many Christians that take the Bible literally and say it should all apply literally. But frankly, if you look at the world's 2.2 billion Muslims, Christians that believe that are a minority. The majority of Christians in the world, particularly the Catholics, the Orthodox, and some other denominations, believe that, yes, there is much in the Bible that is literal, but there is much that should be understood figuratively or symbolically or allegorically or things like that. This viewpoint of non-literalism is a minority viewpoint in Islam. And in fact, it's only held among some sects of Islam. It is generally considered by mainstream Sunnism and by mainstream Twelver Shiism, to a certain extent, to be rank apostasy. And this is why it is so hard for Muslims, for instance, to say condemn things like beheadings. I wrote an article on beheading back in 2005. If your listeners want to Google it, it's called Beheading in the Name of Islam. It's really, unfortunately, I'm known for this, one of the few articles, scholarly articles ever written on beheading in Islam. And I looked at the Quran and these hadiths, which I'll get to in a second. But I looked at Islam across Islamic thought by commentators, the two different passages of the Quran, Surat al-Muhammad verses 3 and 4 and Surat al-Anfal verse 12, which say behead the unbelievers when you encounter them on the battlefield and elsewhere. Okay, and, problematic issues in the Bible, for instance, Christians will say, well, it doesn't apply to us. And the example I always use is the snake handling one. In Matthew and in Luke, I believe it is, Jesus tells the disciples, you'll be able to do things like pick up poison snakes and drink poison and things like that. Now, 99.9% of us think that only applied to the apostles that were standing there when Jesus said it.
Right.
Of course, then you have these guys in these churches, and I knew some of them growing up in Kentucky, the so-called snake handler churches, where they take the copperheads and the water moccasins out on at Sunday night services. And there's a reason, Derek, why there aren't very many snake handler Christians. Okay?
Yeah.
But they take it literally. Say so applied in Jesus' time applies now. And again, most Christians don't think like that. Okay, but in Islam, you're not allowed to say, well, the beheading passage is only applied when Muhammad said it. To Ali when he told Ali to behead people making fun of him, which he actually did. It has to apply now. So ISIS therefore has the exegetical upper hand, or any other group that wants to behead. They'll say, well, we're just doing what the Quran literally says. And people can pretend all day long that it's not Islamic, but there it is. And if you don't like the fact that maybe somebody says this on Fox, which actually nobody will, my experience being on Fox is they're as politically correct as the rest of them for the most part.
Yep.
Which is why I think it's kind of funny about you talking about alternative media people. But go get a Quran yourself and read it, although there are not very many good translations. Read it yourself. Or go look at my website. I break this stuff down. So that's the Quran. That's the number one source. And just sort of barely below that, because the Quran's one, at 1A, are the hadiths. Okay, hadith means basically saying or utterance. And there are many, many, many thousands of hadiths that are alleged to be the sayings of Muhammad. So they are of only slightly less authority than the Quran. Basically, the Quran is believed to be not the word of Muhammad, but the word of Allah himself. The hadiths are believed to be the words of Muhammad. And the Sunnis have at least four major collections, multi-volume collections of hadiths. The Shia have a whole bunch more, because the hadiths for the Shia are not simply what Muhammad said, but particularly the Twelver Shia, which is the majority in Iran and Iraq, the largest group of the Shia, believe that there were 12 imams after Muhammad who should have been the legitimate leaders of the community, and that these guys' utterances also count as hadiths. So they've got many, many, many more hadiths to deal with.
Okay.
But if we just stick with Sunnis, okay, so Sunnis, again, who are 85% of the world's Muslims, you've got, beside the Quran, you've got these hadiths. Now, a lot of the hadiths deal with stuff that's in the Quran, and there's sort of commentary on it. Like, there's quite a bit in the Quran about Jesus. And again, he's quite different from Jesus of the Bible, but he's in there. And a lot of hadiths deal with Jesus. But there are a lot of hadiths that deal with things that aren't in the Quran at all. And the primary example, the main one I've studied, is the Mahdi. Again, the primary messianic figure of Islam. The Mahdi is nowhere mentioned in the Quran. There are pretty extensive hadiths about it, but the many Muslims probably the slight majority of Muslims that don't believe in the Mahdi would say, well, we don't believe in it because it's not in the Quran. It's only in the Hadith. So you have that argument between Muslims. But so there's that. There are other sources of Islamic authority, too. I mean, those are the two primary written sources. But basically, there are several different aspects to Islamic authority that contribute to the development of Sharia law or Islamic law. Commentary by famous scholars over the years. They look at this. There's something called ijma, which is consensus of the scholars. What have the scholars said about an issue over the years, like beheading or how many wives you can have or how do you treat infidels or, you know, whatever. Sometimes very picayune things, right? Like how to wash your hands before prayer, things like that. I mean, there's just tons of these things. These people will issue fatwas, you know, Islamic religious rulings over the years, and then eventually they had, and again, over 1,436 years it is now of Islamic history, you've got thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of scholarly opinions, and they break down into several major schools of what's called fiqh, Islamic jurisprudence, Hanbali, Hanafi, Maliki, and Shafi'i, that's on the Sunni side, and then the Shia have their own different schools of what's called Islamic jurisprudence. So you've got all of this mixed in there, okay? And the thing is, what it amounts to, really, Derek, is there is no one authority in Islam.
Hmm.
You can't even say that the Quran alone is an authority because there are Muslims that will say, well, we read the Quran and we don't really like the Hadith. They're a minority, but you do have folks like that. And you can also pick and choose, which is what ISIS does very well in Dabiq. A lot of the terrorist groups will do this. They will take something that's legitimately Muslim, like beheading or like, you know, polygamy. Surat al-Nisa clearly says you're allowed four wives. And it also says, by the way, that if they misbehave, you're allowed to beat them. It clearly says that. Again, I've read this in Arabic. This wasn't made up by Dick Cheney's staff or anything. Okay? It says that. But what they will do is they will pick and choose from the glosses, from the commentaries, from the scholarly consensus to say, well, we only pick scholars that say things we like to hear, like you're allowed to behead unbelievers whenever you want. And so they'll pick people like famously Ibn Taymiyyah, who lived in the 14th century, or Ibn Abdul Wahhab, the founder of the Wahhabi sect in Saudi Arabia, who are really sort of the hardest core, right? So that's what they will do. You know, any dissenting voices, any contrarian voices, they will just ignore because they'll say, well, they're not true Muslims. So, but what this really boils down to, Derek, in a lot of ways, is that it's a fight within Islam for what's legitimate. Is it accurate to say ISIS is not Islamic? No, they're very Islamic. Are they the totality of Islam? No. This is where I take issue with, you know, some of my conservative brethren. It is no more. If it is incorrect to say that Islam is original religion of peace, which it clearly is incorrect to say because jihad is intrinsic to Islam, it is also equally wrong to say Islam is only a religion of the sword and of war, because that's clearly not the case either. Because, again, it's the world's second largest religion. There are not just Sunni and Shia, but there are dozens, if not hundreds, of sects in Islam. And many of them believe, you know, different things from the other ones. Okay. There are some common denominators. Again, as I said, it is true that a literal reading of the Quran is the primary mainstream understanding in Sunni Islam. And again, this is why groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram and a lot of these other really hardcore groups that we call terrorist groups, because they are, this is why it's so hard to refute them from an Islamic point of view. I'm reading a little book right now I just got from... Oh, it's downstairs. I left it downstairs. It's by, oh no, I found it right here. It is by Sheikh Muhammad al-Yaqubi, who is a prominent Syrian sheikh and a Sufi of a different order than the ones I mentioned earlier. It's called, English translation is Refuting ISIS, a Rebuttal of Its Religious and Ideological Foundations. It's published in English, and I got it, and it's about 60, 65 pages. And, you know, I really want to like this book. And, you know, all due respect to the good sheikh, who I'm sure understands Islam better than me, but the argument basically in his book boils down to ISIS is not Islamic because I don't like them.
Okay.
Because they're making Muslims look bad.
Ah.
he's not really refuting ISIS on the basis. He does point out, as I said, that they do pick certain scholars like Ibn Taymiyyah, and they don't adduce, you know, contrary scholars, you know. But what it boils down to basically, and this guy is a heavy hitter, okay, in the Islamic world, all right? And this is just not getting it done. His argument, again, basically boils down to he's not refuting ISIS, and I've read all their Dabiq magazines, which is the name of their magazine, too, named after that town where the Armageddon battle is supposed to take place. They adduce the Quran. They adduce many, many, many hadiths. They adduce scholars, again, a sort of narrow range of scholars, but they are legitimate scholars within Islam. And so you can't just refute them by saying you're not Muslim and sort of sticking your fingers in your ears and wagging them. That's really not going to do it. You're going to have to deconstruct. But here's the problem, Derek. Again, it goes back to what I was saying. The problem with deconstructing the ideological foundations of groups like ISIS and Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda and so on and so forth is that they are Quranic literalists. So if you attack them, you would have to say, you know that stuff about beheading that you're doing? That doesn't apply to us. That applied in the Prophet Muhammad's time. It doesn't apply to us. But see, that's not acceptable in Islam, Derek. Mm-hmm. You can't say that. If you say that, you yourself are an apostate. So that's the problem. And this is why I tell people, look, I'm sorry, but people talk about an Islamic reformation. I don't even know that that's the right word. Islam has to get to the point where they can tolerate their own sects, S-E-C-T-S, without coming down on them for saying. There are some sects of Islam that say things like this. There's a group called the Ahmadis who developed in India in the late 19th century. They had a guy who called Ghulam Ahmad Shah, who claimed to be the Mahdi and the returned Jesus rolled into one. Okay, and his group, there are about 15, maybe 20 million of them. And they are truly moderate. They have abandoned jihad, but they are considered to be, you know, basically wackos by mainstream Muslims because they believe this guy was the Mahdi and Jesus, which contravenes normal Sunni thought, which says that neither one of them showed up yet. But, you know, there are sects like that. If you add them up, there are probably maybe 80, 90 million out of 1.5 billion members of these sects that believe this. So it's going to be decades, if not, I hate to say this, but if not centuries before mainstream Islam gets to this point where it's willing to say the Quran doesn't have to be read literally. Because now if you say that, you are in danger of your own life in many countries around the world. I mean, people may say, you know, look, I was raised Southern Baptist, and I always tell my people I'm a recovering Southern Baptist. But, you know, even the hardest core Southern Baptists, I'm pretty sure no longer kill you for saying that you don't believe in the literal rendering of the Bible. You know, I mean, Hollywood and the intelligentsia likes to pretend that Christians are that bad, but they really aren't.
No.
I mean, even Bill Maher has admitted that finally. But it took a while to get to that point, and it's going to take Islam a while to get to the point. In the meantime, the people that believe that sort of thing are killing people in Paris.
With 1,400 years of Islamic history behind us and this idea that they've not yet moved to a point where they can tolerate somebody saying, well, we can't accept this because this doesn't apply anymore. Have we seen, you know, what other movements are there historically that have tried to do what the Islamic State is trying to do now?
Oh, what the Islamic State is doing? Well, let's see. Do you mean in terms of jihad? There have been many, 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 many. If you mean in terms of jihad plus the apocalyptic element?
Yes.
Well, there have been a surprisingly large number. Again, I dealt with those. I dealt with some of those, I should say, in my book from 2005, Holiest Wars, which I wrote that book because when I was in grad school at Ohio State and started studying Islamic apocalyptic and such and jihads that were centered around this such a belief, particularly someone claiming to be the Mahdi, the sort of conventional wisdom, particularly even in scholarly community, was that it was mainly, you know, a 12 or Shia phenomenon. And I actually had taken a class on jihads in African history with a nice Sudanese scholar, a wonderful man, Ahmed Sikanga. I was surprised to find out that, of course, that this major, one of the major Mahdi movements in history, the Sudanese Mahdi, a guy named Muhammad Ahmed of the 1880s, about whom the movie Khartoum was made, mm-hmm. with Charlton Heston and Laurence Olivier, one of Olivier's worst roles, by the way, I hate to say that, but that this group was Sunni. And then I started doing some research into it and found that there have been a whole lot of guys leading movements in Islamic history that were claiming to be, you know, sort of apocalyptic, eschatological movements, and the guy leading it claiming to be the Mahdi, that they were Sunni. So anyway, so I dealt with eight of these in that book. I bring up a bunch more in my new book, 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps, which, by the way, it's sort of an unwieldy title, but I did it because it's sort of an inside joke. There is a very famous book that came out in the late 19th century, early 20th century, by a British major who interviewed a Viennese, an Austrian priest who had been captured by this Mahdi, the Sudanese Mahdi that I was just talking about, by his people, and held as a slave for 10 years.
Wow.
This poor priest. The man finally got loose, and the British wound up with the British in Egypt, and the British debriefed him, and the guy debriefing him was this British major who actually wrote a book about it. So it was called 10 Years Captivity in the Mahdi's Camp. So that was the take-up of my book. But basically, I talk about this quite a bit. And it's, again, it's not something just of ancient history either. In Turkey in the 1930s, there was a movement after the Ottoman Empire had fallen apart and the Turkish Republic was established. There was a movement by some guy claiming to be the Mahdi in Turkey. It was crushed by Turkish military forces, but it was there in Western Turkey. In recent years, the most prominent example would be 1979. You're probably familiar with this, Derek. A lot of people aren't. A lot of people are familiar with the movement, but they don't realize it was eschatological. In 1979, a group occupied the Great Mosque in Mecca. Right? It was a group led by a guy called Juhayman al-Oktabi, and they, for about 3 weeks, took over the Great Mosque in Mecca, and they put people up in the minarets and were broadcasting that the Mahdi had come. And because this guy, Juhayman al-Oktabi, had decided, and whether he believed it or not, I don't know, but he certainly acted like it, that his brother-in-law, a guy named Muhammad al-Qahtani, was the Mahdi. So these guys had taken over, and the Saudis took it so seriously. The Saudis, first of all, could not militarily evict them. They wound up getting the French to do it. But they had to, they actually had to have Sheikh bin Baz, who at that time was the chief mufti in Saudi Arabia, publish fatwas in the newspapers, in Arabic, of course, saying, people, calm down. This is not really the Mahdi. So that was one of the most recent prominent examples. I mean, it failed, but for about 3 weeks, the Saudis were not in good shape with that. What's happened again is, I mean, there's sort of a confluence of events, I guess you could say, that have led to sort of the ramped up eschatology of groups like ISIS. And part of it, of course, is that the United States occupied a country in the central Islamic world, which was Iraq. Okay, it's very important. If you look at sort of the, and I break this down again in a couple places in my book, the eschatological tableau, if you will, for Islam is mainly Syria and to a certain extent Iraq, but mainly Syria. You would think it would be Arabia, right, with Mecca and Medina, and there are hadiths to say that Mahdi will come from Mecca. But most of what the Mahdi does in the hadiths in terms of fighting infidels and so on and so forth, fighting the Dajjal, which he and Jesus will do together, and Jesus will kill the Dajjal, that all takes place for the most part in Syria. So Syria has great eschatological resonance in Islam. So part of that, part of what ISIS is doing is because of that. And again, there are many, I think, who would tend to say that what ISIS is doing is purely exploitative, that they don't really believe this, that as I mentioned earlier, you know, the huge percentage of Muslims that do believe it, that ISIS is sort of piggybacking on that. But I don't think that's true. Again, I think that, you know, and Will McCants also has a really good book out on this topic. Will's at Brookings. And I forgot the name of his book, but he just came out with a book about a month or so ago on specifically on ISIS eschatology. And Will talks about this, so that the leadership of ISIS and its predecessor movements, very enamored of this. So, but they aren't the only ones that hold this. I mean, there are other groups around the world, some terrorist and some not, that believe in the coming of the Mahdi. I mean, there are several prominent Turkish groups. You probably heard of Fethullah Gulen.
Yes.
I bet you have. Gulen lives in Pennsylvania. He was evicted from Turkey in the early 1990s, back when Turkey was much more secular.
Right.
Gulen is a Sufi. He's a Turkish Sufi, or Sufi Turk, if you will, who believes in the Mahdi. He's very important because he's very prominent. In fact, a couple years ago, there was some magazine that ranked the world's 100 public intellectuals, and he was number one. His organization, the Gulen organization, G-U-L-E-N, with a little umlaut on the U, runs, I think, next to the Catholic Church, I believe it's the world's largest religious school network.
Yeah, and it's the largest group of charter schools in the United States.
Right. Right. In the United States, they operate ostensibly as STEM schools, right? Science, technology, engineering, math.
Right.
But there's been a lot of people that say that they also sub rosa, you know, inject a lot of Islamic beliefs in. But outside of the United States, they're very Islamic. And I don't think that's all necessarily bad, because the brand of Islam that the Gulen people promote is quite peaceful. And it's very anti-jihadi in many ways. So, you know, if I had to have a choice between the Taliban or ISIS or Al-Qaeda and Gulen, I'll take Gulen, as I've written, every day and twice on Friday. But the Gulenistas, as they're called, believe in the Mahdi, but they believe in a peaceful Mahdi. In fact, Gulen says in his writings that the Mahdi will win people over with education, not a sword. So, I mean, it's not the Mahdi that ISIS believes in. And there are other movements. It's the primary messianic belief system in Islam. So it's not simply there's a spectrum of beliefs ranging from, you know, peaceful to violent and everything in between. And sometimes there's a mixture. I mean, you know, I went to Iran, as you know, I went to Iran in 2008 to a conference specifically on this topic. And you know, the papers on all kinds of different things, and these Iranian believers, true believers, talking about it. And you know, some of them give you pause. Like, I remember there was one paper speculating on whether the Mahdi would allow Jews and Christians to convert or simply kill all of us. And so I decided I would not bring up any questions at that particular panel. But, you know, there are many Muslims, particularly Shia, I should say, interestingly enough, 12 are Shia in Iran, that believe that the Mahdi will, yes, he will be a military leader, but he won't force people to believe in Islam, that people will come to believe in it. And it will be more of what's called dawah, which is sort of, you know, Islamic almost evangelism as opposed to jihad. But, you know, there's also many, many groups and people that believe that the Mahdi basically is a global warlord, and he will conquer the world in the name of Islam. And it'd be, you know, his way or the highway. And ISIS, as you, with your question, ISIS is only the latest manifestation of this. This is not a radical understanding. There have been dozens, if not hundreds, of groups in Islamic history that believe that their leader was the Mahdi, and it was eschatological time was coming. I mean, the Ottoman Empire in its time, the Ottomans fought against these guys. There were dozens of Mahdist movements within the Ottoman Empire by self-styled messianic leaders that, you know, the Ottomans pretty much always crushed because they had a lot of military power. But they had a sort of a continuing problem with this.
In a sense, it reminds me of reading between the lines of the New Testament, where you see the Sanhedrin always looking at these, you know, this new sect of Christ followers, you know, these guys following this Yeshua ben Yosef. And is he just another one of these radicals who wants to rebel against Rome, like this other guy or this other guy or this other guy? Almost like, you know, from the Monty Python film Life of Brian, where you've got all these radical movements, like one following after another to just, you know, really not accomplishing anything, but just, you know, committing suicide in front of the, you know, in front of the cross. Just silliness.
There was the Bar Kokhba revolt and many, many others. Yes. In the first century B.C. up through 70 A.D., and remember, the Romans occupied the Holy Land in about 63 BC.
Right.
The Romans had Jewish messianic pretenders leading revolts, mm-hmm. were a continual thorn in the Roman side.
Right.
And And that really, if you don't understand that context, you don't understand why Pilate reacted like he did with Jesus. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because this was, Jesus was only the latest in a long line of guys that somebody thought was the Messiah. Now, Jesus, unlike the other guys, didn't tell his followers to pick up swords and kill Romans.
Right.
But Pilate didn't know that wasn't going to happen. You know, and Pilate was already in hot water with the emperor, so that's a whole other issue. But
right,
but,
yeah.
But basically, yeah, I mean, going back for, I mean, decades before Jesus, and even after him, you had messianic revolts by zealots and by other groups in Roman Judea that they had to deal with. So Jesus was seen by the Romans as just another one of these guys. Yeah.
So
it's very similar. And again, but sorry, it's very similar to what's going on with Islam. But the difference, of course, is that for Islam, because Islam is so much a larger religion than Judaism, again, second only to Christianity, it's believed to be operative on a global scale.
Yeah.
So that's a big difference here. So, I mean, ISIS is convinced that then the Mahdi's going to come. They're going to defeat us. It'll be us because they think we're the Crusaders. We're the modern Rome, the modern Christian Romans. And that the Mahdi will come and the Mahdi and Jesus will then lead them to conquer the entire world. They really believe this. And again, ISIS is not the only group that believes this. There are other groups that believe it. And they get resonance for this. And this is something I think people haven't looked at. You know, you keep seeing these analyses, and why do these Western jihadis, why do these kids from France and Belgium and even the United States or wherever go join ISIS? And they're always looking at, you know, social anime, and they're always looking at, you know, things like that. I always tell people, well, you know, 19-year-olds are not really thinking particularly with the brain at the top of their head that much. So.
Yeah.
You know, there's that element of a young man wants to go do something that he violent and he thinks is very worthwhile and all that stuff. But I think something that no one looks at is, and I wish someone would analyze this, to what extent do these eschatological beliefs factor in and attract these guys? Because you're basically telling people, look, we are on the cusp of Islam taking over the world because the Mahdi is about to come, and we're basically setting the stage for the Mahdi with what they're doing in Syria. So come on over and help us do it. I think that really is a big draw to that a lot of analysts don't even think about.
Yeah, and at the risk of offending Christians who are listening, there is an element of that in some of the charismatic movement among charismatic Christians here in the United States, especially those that are really reaching out to youth and telling them that they're the generation that's literally going to defeat the Antichrist and death and will be imbued with superpowers, essentially, for the purposes.
You know, Ben Carson made a remark sort of not quite that strong, but, you know, a couple of weeks ago, actually I blogged on this, Ben Carson was asked in an interview, and, you know, he's a Seventh-day Adventist,
mm-hmm.
and they have very strong beliefs about eschatology, and he basically said that he thinks we're living in the end times. And yeah, it's, you know, that's something else I've written about, Derek, too, is people I want to take a look at. I've got an entire chapter sort of bouncing, it's comparing Christian and Muslim eschatology. And primarily, I'm talking about evangelical Christians because most of the rest of us aren't as, you know, worried about eschatology as evangelicals are, and they really are. And what I have found in the last decade, 15 years studying this topic, is that, particularly since 9/11, the evangelical Christian world and the Muslim world in many ways has sort of become mirror opposites of each other. And they're like staring at each other. I mean, there are evangelical pastors and scholars who are writing things about, of course, the Antichrist of Revelation being the Mahdi.
Right.
You know, and believing that and trying to shoehorn what's going on with ISIS and everything else into, you know, the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel, which, by the way, I don't do because I don't think I go along with what Jesus told the disciples in Matthew 24, which is what you're not going to figure out. So
yeah.
Don't waste your time.
Yeah. I do. Full disclosure, you know, try to study eschatology as much as I can, but I think it's deliberately obscure for the reason that the enemy, the principalities, powers, rulers of this present darkness, are far more intelligent than we are. And if it was really clear to us, it would be really, really easy for those supernatural entities that seek to do us harm to fabricate a really convincing lie. So we'll figure it out when It's like my friend says, he's pan-tribulationist. It's all going to pan out in the end.
Well, I'll just leave it at, I'm a Christian. Like I said, I'm Lutheran. I believe Jesus is coming back. I don't think that I can figure out what it's going to be. But my problem is, as an analytical lens, is people that will take people that are, experts in Christian eschatology and then try to take elements of Islamic eschatology and make it fit.
Right, right.
Again, that goes back to what I was talking about earlier, because when you're doing that, you aren't trying to understand Muslims on their own terms.
Right.
You're shoehorning your agenda onto them.
And I think from another perspective, I think that's a little too obvious for the enemy. I mean, if we're going to credit Satan with being the father of lies, he's probably going to come up with something that's a little harder for us to discern than just saying, well, this guy who's leading this group of people who've been saying openly that they want to behead you and kill you and take your daughters is the Antichrist. Now, I think he's going to be just a little more subtle than that.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah.
Right. Right. I'm not sure he will be as suave as, what's his name in The Omen?
Who's
the actor, the British actor that I like, the guy that played Jurassic Park.
Sam Neill, right.
Yeah, Sam Neill, right. Sam Neill. Probably won't be that suave, but yeah, I think you're right. It probably won't be quite as crass as ISIS, who are, about as subtle as a beheading.
Exactly. Well, you got two new books out, 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps and Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate. How do the two books differ from one another in your approach to helping us understand this radical Mahdism?
Well, let me say real quick, Sex, Lies, and the Caliphate will actually probably be out next week.
Okay.
But the other one's out. But yeah, thank you for saying that. The difference is this, 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps is specifically on Islamic eschatology. And I focus like a laser beam. Sorry. I focus as much as I can on ISIS and on Iran. I talk about other elements. I talk about some history, like I said, with this thing about the Ottomans dealing with this sort of thing. But I have very long chapters on ISIS and on Iran. So it's mainly eschatology, apocalyptic, that sort of thing. Sex, Lies, and the Caliphate, I don't entirely steer clear of eschatology, but I mostly deal with basically Islamic, the doctrines of Islam that are problematic, and I also deal with Islamic sects. And again, I always have to say this when I'm talking to the military, that's S-E-C-T-S. I talk about things like jihad, and I talk about, like I was talking with you earlier, about beheading, jihad. Elements of Islam that we are told continually by people like the CIA director and the President of the United States that really aren't Islamic. And I talk about how, well, they actually are Islamic. And until we admit that, and the Muslim world deals with them, as, the President of Egypt said back in January, it's going to continue to be a problem. They're going to continue to be problems that bedevil the world. So I also talk about, as I mentioned earlier, I talk about the different sects of Islam, not just Sunni and Shia, but some of these other folks that I talked about, like Ahmadis and Sufis. And a lot of people don't know that besides the 12 or Shia, there are two other major groups of Shia, the Seveners or the Ismailis and the Fivers or the Zaydis, which are the ones in Yemen, who have slightly different beliefs. I talk about groups like the Alawis in Syria. But I just want to let everybody know that I tried to write these books. I've rewritten a lot of it, but a lot of it is stuff that I've written before, and a lot of it is some articles that I published in places like History News Network that have either disappeared or gotten buried. And what I've done is arranged them chronologically and topically, and I've tried to write them so that it's not scholarly, okay? I mean, I have a couple, maybe there's a couple of chapters that have footnotes, but for the most part, it's just I'm talking about things. I provide links, particularly in the Kindle version. I got links to radio interviews, TV interviews I did, to other sources if people want to check it. So I really think both books could work as, they're complementary, and one's eschatology and one is sort of non-eschatology Islam. And I think they will help explain a lot of the stuff that's going on, because I trace the development really over the last decade of like things like, why are groups beheading? I trace the development of why, again, this belief in the Mahdi seems to increase so much here in the 21st century, things like that.
Hmm. I will post a link to Tim's website, MahdiWatch.org, as well as to a couple of articles that I've at least one that I've referred to before, What's Worse Than Violent Jihadists, which is the article from 2005 in which he lays out the almost a prophetic prediction of the rise of the Islamic State. Also, the article he mentioned during the interview here regarding the beheading in the name of Islam. I'll put links to those in the show notes at vftb.net, as well as links to the two new books. I've got the one on my Kindle already, starting to go through it and highlight it. And I think this is going to be really helpful and educational to better understand what's actually going on in the Middle East. And I think the key takeaway, at least for me, is that this is a has got much longer historical roots than most of us in the West are aware. If you had to pick, say, or at least identify one takeaway or what you hope a reader would get out of these books, either both or the two books separately, if they're different goals, purposes for writing them, Tim, what would you hope that a reader coming in would get from these books?
Well, from the 10 Years Captivation book, it would be, I think, as we both mentioned, that Mahdism, the belief in the Mahdi, and the belief that some leader's coming to bring about the events that will cause Islam to take over the world is, you know, we got it with ISIS, but it goes way back. It may not go quite 1,400 years back, but it goes probably at least 1,300 years back in Islamic history. So it's nothing new, and it's really, frankly, not that far out of the mainstream. The other book, I think, the other book in some ways I think maybe is more hopeful, because I point out in that book, again, that although there are many lies in Islam, in fact, there's an entire doctrine devoted to allowing you to lie to non-Muslims called taqiyya or kitman, mm-hmm. that many Muslim groups want the caliphate. But I also point out that there are sects of Islam that are not violent, that read the Quran differently from the ISISs of the world, or for that matter, from the Al-Azhars of the world in Cairo. And that these groups, I think, are increasingly speaking out, and I think that eventually these sects of Islam that are not literalist will, I think, help lead the other Muslims, although it may take years, as I said, help lead other Muslims to the point where Muslims will disabuse themselves of the violent jihadists.
Hmm. Dr. Timothy Furnish, the author of the two new books, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate, and 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps. I'm going to have to learn to pronounce that correctly. It's Mahdi and not Mahdi.
Either one works for me, Derek.
Okay. We hope that we can get you out here to the Ozarks at some point, but we'll talk about this after the program. Tim Furnish, thank you very much for your work. Your website, MahdiWatch.org, and thank you especially for giving up time on this holiday weekend.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
In the show notes at vftb.net, you will find a link to Dr. Furnish's website, Mahdi Watch or Mahdi Watch. Forgive the pronunciation, .org. And he blogs there fairly frequently, but you'll also find links from there to where to get the copies of the books. I'll put links to that in the show notes as well. I've been reading 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps, and in the early chapters, finding a lot of interesting nuggets. And I really appreciate the fact that with Kindle, you can highlight stuff. So, and then go back and then search through your highlights, which makes it really easy for me to like take notes and then go back and refer to them. And he makes some really interesting points, which I'm sure many, so-called moderate Muslims, and I shouldn't put, you know, I guess the scare disclaimer in front of the word moderate Muslims, those that don't agree with the interpretation of the Quran and the Hadiths of the Islamic State, might take issue with, but he points out a number of things. First of all, in response to people like President Obama, who want to wag their finger at Christians and say, remember the Crusades, Dr. Furnish writes, since the 30 Years' War and the Enlightenment, so we're talking like since the 18th century, 17th century, Christians have abandoned killing each other in the name of their religion, and in fact, Western Christian civilization is the one among the world's cultures that developed the idea of religious tolerance. He also writes, quote, Muslims in the Islamic cultural zone, however, are still mired in religious intolerance and far too often violence against their own sects, a sad reality which no amount of American occupation and constitution writing will change. And one other interesting observation, Muslim sectarian minorities have every reason to fear the usually Sunni majority far more than they do Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, or even Jews. That is the state of Islam today. He also begins the book, 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps, with a summary and an analysis of research done by the Pew Research Group on what Muslims believe, and found that there is a very high percentage of Muslims around the world who believe that the Mahdi will return within their lifetime. And while that may not seem all that unusual to this listening audience, because you, if you're listening to this program, have a good probability that you're predisposed to believe that the Messiah will return at some point fairly soon. But the main difference is that in the Muslim world, we seem to be contributing to the spread of apocalyptic eschatology within the Muslim world. The two nations with the highest percentage of people expecting the near-term appearance of the Mahdi is Afghanistan, 83%, and Iraq, 72%. I think it's not out of the realm of possibility that the long occupation by the American military has contributed to the to the spread of apocalyptic Mahdism in those two nations. And sadly, it is from that well that the water of the Islamic State is drawn. So, information from somebody who's actually studied Islam. And the reason I find this useful and interesting is that it is a perspective different from the one that we get on from the mainstream media, the talking heads on the cable news channels, or on conservative talk radio, who are certainly entitled to their opinions, but I would prefer to draw my conclusions from educated opinions. And Dr. Furnish is a credentialed scholar whose background is in studying the writings of Muslims themselves to determine what it is they believe and then draw conclusions from that. And the fact that he has served as a consultant to the intelligence community and Special Operations Command, and has military experience himself with the 101st Airborne, I think gives him a perspective that you and I could benefit from. So, again, I hope, no promises, but hope we can get him out to the Ozarks and use our resources here to make his work a little more widely known. But I will point out that both Chris Putnam and Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis have drawn on the research of Dr. Timothy Furnish for their books. So, our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, concluded the book of Joshua today. So we move on to the book of Judges next week. We post a new Bible study, generally just about an hour in length, where we go through the scriptures verse by verse and try to exegete it to the best of our ability. Bearing in mind that neither Sharon or I are Christian or are biblical scholars, but we do our best to try to draw out of the text more than what appears on first read. Typically posted about mid-morning, and on the first Sunday of every month, we also celebrate communion. We know it's a virtual thing, and we're celebrating it at different times depending on when you actually download and listen to the MP3 file, but we appreciate you making it a part of your routine. And again, today we conclude with the division of the land of Canaan among the tribes of Israel, and of course Joshua with his final remarks before he passed, including the declaration, which all of us should agree with. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. On Tuesday night, Skywatch TV, Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. He was in the Ozarks about 6-8 weeks ago, and we talked about his book, Never Submit. Of course, you heard his program here on A View from the Bunker just recently, which was about a half-hour interview conducted for one of the daily updates on Skywatch TV. We've got a couple of programs with him coming up at skywatchtv.com. You'll see the program on the Christian Television Network Tuesday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 8:30 p.m. Central Time, DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267, or on the Christian Television Network's live internet stream at ctnonline.com. And then later in the week, on the Skywatch TV channels on Roku and YouTube. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.